a sweeping democracy reform bill that would put in place measures like automatic registration, election day registration, early voting, expanded mail voting in all 50 states. And I think it's more important than ever, given these voter suppression laws. It's going to be hard to challenge all of these laws in Florida, Texas, Georgia through the courts. And I think it makes federal legislation all the more important. And it's very clear that Democrats are either going to pass legislation to protect democracy, or the Republican Party is going to undermine the democratic process for the next decade and beyond at the state level.
Ari Berman, we want to thank you for being with us. We'll link to your pieces. Reporter for Mother Jones, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And that does it for our broadcast. Again, if you want to sign up for our daily digest, get our news headlines and news alerts daily, you can send the word Democracy Now, one word without a space. You can text that to 66866. That's 66866. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, and the whole miraculous team that makes Democracy Now! Happen every day. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Tune into The Metal Margin, fourth Thursdays from 3 to 5:30 a.m. to hear women and people of color represented in metal. That's The Metal Margin with me, The Metal Maestra, on fourth Thursdays at 3 a.m. here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the Spring Membership Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland calls the U.S. Department of Justice hypocritical for criticizing its response to 2020's racial justice protests. The Biden administration restores LGBTQ bias protection in healthcare, and the FDA authorizes Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children ages 12 to 15. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 10th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 388 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 191,774. Oregon health officials also reported 3 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 2,533 people. There are currently 326 people hospitalized statewide, including 78 patients in intensive care units. So far, more than 49% of Oregonians have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 36% of the state's population fully vaccinated. Walk-ins for vaccinations are now welcome at the Oregon Convention Center, as well as the Portland International Airport drive-through site for people looking to get vaccinated. Officials announced on Monday that the Oregon Convention Center vaccination site will be offering first doses of the vaccine until May 27th and shifting to second doses only starting June 1st before closing on June 19th. The site has been open since January 20th and has administered almost 465,000 COVID vaccinations. One of the reasons the site is closing is because demand for the vaccine has diminished as it becomes available in other locations and as more Oregonians have gotten vaccinated. The Food and Drug Administration announced on Monday that they have authorized Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for children 12 to 15 years old. This will make millions of more people under the age of 18 eligible to receive a COVID vaccine. In late March, Pfizer said Phase 3 clinical data showed that its COVID-19 vaccine was 100% effective in preventing the illness in children 12 to 15 years old. The Pfizer vaccine is the only one currently available for people under the age of 18, but it is likely that it will soon be joined by others. Nationally, there have been 32.7 million cases of COVID-19. At least 581,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 41,000 new cases reported per day, a 30% decrease from the average 2 weeks earlier. So far, more than 46% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, with 35% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 158.3 million people in nearly every country. At least 3.2 million people have died across the world. Interest is growing in traveling this summer as more people become vaccinated. A webinar on Tuesday has tips for Oregonians on what to expect. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
With vaccination rates increasing, people are making summer plans again. A webinar is offering Oregonians tips to keep in mind when traveling. Walter Marchbanks, Passenger Programs and Services Manager for the Port of Portland, senses there's a lot of pent-up demand since many didn't take trips last year. He also recognizes that travel during the pandemic can be stressful, so the Portland Airport is doing what it can to make people feel comfortable.
We look at it as being able to provide some information, some resources about what the airport is doing to help keep people safe, the types of cleaning that we're doing, the safety protocols and measures that we put in place.
The CDC recommends people delay travel until they are fully vaccinated. The webinar is Tuesday at 11:30 a.m. It's sponsored by AARP, Portland International Airport, and Travel Oregon. Marchbanks says one of the changes at the airport is that people greeting travelers are not permitted.
Only on exception if they're providing assistance to people that might need help. So if you have to help a family member to the ticket counter so that they can get a wheelchair, or meet somebody that's coming off a flight and greeting the wheelchair provider, and, you know, that type of thing.
Marchbanks says people can check out the Portland Airport's website to learn more about what to expect, especially if they have accessibility issues and need more details on arrangements. He also notes that there are folks in the airport who can answer questions.
The website will get you so far, but people need direct help. They need direct service.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The city of Portland has called the U.S. Department of Justice hypocritical for penalizing the city's police for injuring protesters at last summer's racial justice protests. In February, the DOJ announced that because of the way Portland police handled the protests, the city was no longer in compliance with a 2014 settlement agreement that was initially formed to curtail Portland police officers' use of force against people experiencing mental illness. Because Portland officers violated their own use of force policies and failed to adequately investigate police misuse of force, the city had fallen out of compliance. Portland responded to this determination in a 40-page letter filed Friday afternoon. In the letter, the city of Portland calls the DOJ hypocritical for penalizing the city's police, since federal officers also used force against Portland demonstrators. The city also blames federal police for creating an atmosphere that called for more use of force by Portland police. The city's letter is meant to explain to the Department of Justice how it will address the flaws outlined in the February report. According to city attorneys, the city of Portland will meet those requirements by mandating all officers participate in a crowd control training session that will begin in June. The letter also addresses a separate DOJ report filed in March, which critiqued the city's current oversight system. Again, the city said it will largely address those issues with more officer training. It's now up to the DOJ to decide whether or not the city's letter resolves its concerns. If the Department of Justice and the city of Portland can't come to an agreement, they'll be forced into mediation. If the mediation fails, the Department of Justice will likely ask the federal judge who oversees the case to enforce the terms of the settlement agreement. The judge has already scheduled a hearing with the city and the DOJ in August to evaluate the progress, but if they move into mediation, it will likely occur before then. In the wake of the police murder of Dante Wright, Brooklyn Center, Minnesota has come up with new strategies to reform policing. Samantha Honglong with the Racial Reckoning Project has the latest.
Less than a month after veteran police officer Kim Potter shot and killed 20-year-old Dante Wright during a traffic stop, Brooklyn Center Mayor Mike Elliott presented Saturday a series of proposals that would revamp the city's police policies and operations.
This resolution is the first step to a community-centered process that will ultimately remove police from traffic enforcement and create a new Department of Community Safety and Violence Prevention.
The resolution would direct police officers to give citations instead of making arrests for any non-moving traffic infraction or non-felony warrant. This could prevent deaths like Dante Wright's as officers try to arrest him for a non-felony warrant. The proposal also includes a community response department, which would dispatch unarmed staff to respond to low-level traffic violations and mental health calls instead of the police.
Brooklyn Center can do better. Brooklyn Center must do more. And Brooklyn Center is ready for change.
If approved by the City Council, a committee of civilians and experts will work out the plans, details, and budgets. Meanwhile, the city released Potter's service file late Wednesday, overviewing some of her 26 years working in the Brooklyn Center Police Department. The file includes a commendation from the police chief in 2007 for her handling of both a suicidal and homicidal suspect. It also includes a handful of reprimands. Both the police chief and Potter resigned 2 days after the shooting. According to the police department, Potter grabbed her gun instead of her taser. Her next court hearing is May 17th. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Samantha Honglong.
The Department of Health and Human Services announced on Monday that the Biden administration is reversing a policy introduced under former President Donald Trump that limited protections for transgender people in healthcare. The change will prevent healthcare providers and other health-related organizations who receive federal funding from discriminating against people based on their gender identity or sexual orientation. Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra said, quote, "The Supreme Court has made clear that people have a right not to be discriminated against on the basis of sex and receive equal treatment under the law, no matter their gender identity or sexual orientation." In June of 2020, the Trump administration finalized its rollback of protections against gender identity discrimination in healthcare regulated by Obamacare. Days later, the Supreme Court ruled that existing federal law forbids job discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or transgender status. A day before the Trump policy was set to take effect in August of 2020, a federal judge blocked the government from enforcing the regulation. Now, LGBTQ people will have additional protection against discrimination in healthcare. Assistant Secretary for Health Dr. Rachel Levine, who in March became the first openly transgender person confirmed by the Senate to a federal post, said, quote, "The mission of our department is to enhance the health and well-being of all Americans, no matter their gender identity or sexual orientation. No one should be discriminated against when seeking medical services because of who they are." Conservation groups are praising Tracy Stone Manning, President Joe Biden's pick to lead the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. The agency is responsible for managing 245 million acres of publicly owned lands and the nation's onshore underground mineral estate for multiple uses, including energy development, agriculture, and outdoor recreation. Eric Galatis has more on the story for the Public News Service.
President Joe Biden's pick to direct the U.S. Bureau of Land Management is getting high marks from conservationists. Aaron Kendall with the National Wildlife Federation believes Tracy Stone Manning, currently the Federation's senior advisor, is the right person for the job. There hasn't been a Senate-confirmed BLM director since 2017, and Kendall says the agency needs someone who understands what needs to be done to conserve, restore, and steward America's public lands for all users.
Responsible energy development, hunters and anglers, hikers, agricultural businesses that rely on the area for grazing. We need somebody who understands all those things and is ready to work with all of those folks to get the job done.
If confirmed, Stone Manning would be responsible for managing 10,000 employees, 245 million surface acres of land, and the nation's onshore mineral estate. She served as chief of staff for Montana's Democratic governor, Steve Bullock, and directed the state's Department of Environmental Quality. Stone Manning was a vocal critic of the Trump administration's moves to prioritize oil and gas drilling on public public lands. Kendall says the biggest challenge facing Stone Manning could be the BLM's about-face on fossil fuel development, from rapid leasing under Trump to Biden's pause on oil and gas lease sales. The Denver-based Western Energy Alliance has filed suit challenging the pause, arguing the move violates several laws and amounts to a permanent ban.
Finding that sweet spot is going to be the biggest challenge, figuring out what the resources are we need to protect, but then getting back to some semblance of what responsible energy development looks like, and then bringing in the renewables. Renewables are not without impact as well.
Kendall says managing Colorado's 8 million acres of BLM lands and 27 million acres of mineral rights presents unique challenges, in part because of the state's rapidly expanding population.
There's a lot of human and natural resource conflicts and issues. So someone who can look at those issues fairly, understand all the different variables that go into making good decisions, is really what we're going to need in Colorado.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, talking about domestic abuse, how COVID-19 has created new problems for victims, and a landmark bill in the UK that could change countries' approach to the issue. Then at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 76. Today in history, in 1869, the Transcontinental Railroad is completed, unifying the U.S. No longer would western-bound travelers need to take the long and dangerous journey by wagon train. Union Pacific laborers, mostly Civil War veterans of Irish descent, faced harsh conditions while the overwhelmingly immigrant Chinese workforce of the Central Pacific Railroad was forced to work brutal 12-hour workdays. For all the adversity they suffered, the workers laid nearly 2,000 miles of track by 1869. The quote of the day is from civil rights activist and minister Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said, quote, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy." Israeli warplanes bombarded the northern Gaza Strip on Monday, killing at least 21 people, including 9 children, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. An Israeli drone fired several missiles at a crowded street in Beit Hanun in northern Gaza, killing 21 and injuring 65 others. Earlier Monday, the Joint Chamber of Palestinian Resistance Factions demanded that the Israeli authorities stop their attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied Jerusalem. These attacks have been ongoing for the past 3 weeks, with hundreds of civilian worshippers injured by Israeli forces. On Sunday alone, over 100 Palestinians were injured when Israeli forces launched an attack on worshippers at a mosque in the Al-Aqsa complex. The troops entered the mosque along with Israeli paramilitary settlers who have repeatedly voiced their plan to take over the mosque and replace it with a Jewish temple. Palestinian resistance factions set a deadline of 6 p.m. Monday for the Israeli withdrawal, saying that if the Israeli troops did not withdraw by that time, they would retaliate for the violations against the Palestinians in occupied Jerusalem. At 6 p.m., the resistance fired several rockets into Israel from the besieged Gaza Strip. No casualties or damage was reported. After the firing of the rockets, Israeli forces struck hard against the Gaza Strip, killing 21 Palestinian civilians, including 9 children. Yesterday was Mother's Day, and a new survey looks at policies that mothers in the U.S. prioritize. With more on the story, it's Laura Rosbrow Tellum with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. That's my son. I love him a lot. And let's face it, It's been a hard year to be a mother. So we're gonna go beyond the bouquets and look at what policies mothers want most in the U.S. A new survey from the Institute for Women's Policy Research polled more than 1,400 women on their policy priorities for the new administration and Congress. C. Nicole Mason is the Institute's president and CEO.
This year, moms want a little bit more than breakfast in bed. They want paid sick leave. They want equal pay for equal work. They want child care. They want all the things they haven't had for so long.
President Joe Biden's American Families Plan, part of a larger economic recovery package, includes federal child care assistance, a minimum of 12 weeks paid family leave, and better pay for child care workers. Polling suggests most people like it. Critics in Congress say the $1.8 trillion price tag for the plan is too high. And a new analysis from University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business estimates the plan will spend $700 billion more than Biden anticipates, mostly because they don't expect Biden to get as much tax revenue as he predicts. But Mason notes most women are breadwinners in their families, and the pandemic has made it clear what can happen when essential family work supports are missing.
We found out the hard way during the pandemic that women cannot do their jobs if they do not have adequate, high-quality childcare and paid sick leave. It's just not going to happen.
As of March, nearly 1.5 million fewer moms of school-aged children were actively working than a year prior, according to a Census Bureau advisor. Mario Cordona, chief of policy and practice of nonprofit Child Care Aware, thinks the American Family Plan's proposed universal pre-K, child care relief for low and middle income families, and increased investment in early learning is welcome and overdue.
The current system that we have for child care in this country is largely inaccessible for parents and relies on the low wages of early educators, who are largely women. About 40% of them are women of color.
Cordona notes there is an insufficient supply of childcare available.
The lack of childcare that exists in this country, it is so acute. Currently, about half of the population lives in a childcare desert, which means they live in an area where there's an insufficient supply of licensed care.
Cordona says it will take time to build a new childcare workforce that currently, mostly, does not exist. Finally, I'm sad to say this is my last 2021 talks, but you're in good hands with Mary Sherman and Nadia Ramlagan. If you want to continue hearing from me, I'm going to be at Foreign Policy. Follow me on Twitter at L. Rosbrow, R-O-S-B-R-O-W. Erica Lattis contributed reporting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
Alaska's governor announces a land proposal for Alaska Native veterans, and the Navajo Nation reports 100,000 people fully vaccinated against COVID-19. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Alaska Native veterans of the Vietnam War era would be able to receive state land under a proposal Governor Mike Dunleavy announced last week. George Bennett of Sitka says veterans like him faced obstacles to participating in a federal program that offered land allotments to Alaska Natives. It was repealed in 1971, a time when Bennett says veterans who had experienced trauma were coming home from tours in Southeast Asia.
We were just trying to survive another war within our own selves. We survived 365 days in Vietnam. We came home. We were not the same person.
Few Alaska Natives filed claims for allotments for most of the history of the program, which began in 1906, but thousands of claims were filed in the 2 years before it was repealed. Bennett welcomes the governor, proposing that more than 2,000 veterans or their heirs would be able to receive state land. The state proposal follows a 2019 federal law that allows Alaska Native veterans or their heirs to receive 160-acre federal allotments. Dunleavy's proposal would allow the veterans to exchange their federal allotments for state land of equivalent value. He says state land is generally closer to their homes than what they would receive through the federal program. The governor thanked Bennett and other veterans who described their experiences after he announced the proposal.
You know, we weren't there like these folks were, but in those words that were just spoken, we can at least to some extent feel what our veterans go through and have gone through every day.
The proposal would amend a bill the state legislature is already considering. The Navajo Nation has fully vaccinated more than 100,000 people, according to data released last week by the Navajo Area Indian Health Service. According to the tribe, that's more than half of the adult population on the Navajo Nation. President Jonathan Nez is praising the tribe's vaccination efforts and lower numbers of positive COVID-19 cases. The tribe continues to be under a number of COVID-19 emergency orders, including the reservation remaining closed to visitors. President Nez says the next goal is to reach a 75% vaccination rate in order to consider reopening the nation to visitors. The tribe last week also announced COVID-19 safety guidelines for schools to follow as graduation season begins. In-person graduations for high school and college are allowed, but only outdoors. The long list of guidelines includes time limits on events, mask requirements, and a limited number of guests. Navajo Department of Health Executive Director Dr. Jill Jim talked about the graduation guidelines during a virtual town hall last week, saying it's also up to every individual to take precautions.
A lot of this is also our own responsibility. I think by now we've all learned to carry our own, maybe a clear Ziploc bag of extra gloves, extra masks, hand sanitizer. So if you have a little kit that you have that you travel with, that will be helpful. So that way you can just keep that with you. But I think by this time, we all have learned how to carry those items with us to ensure that if we need to protect ourselves, we have that accessible in our own purse and bag or whatnot.
The Navajo Nation is not allowing in-person graduations or promotions for other grades K and up. Those are to be virtual, drive-through, or car parades. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Heavier downpours strain septic systems in some rural areas. When the systems fail, sewage can leak into yards or back up into sinks and bathtubs. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Most Americans simply flush the toilet, and human waste disappears out of sight and out of mind. But in some rural areas, people often face hazardous sewage leaking into their yards or backing up into their sinks and bathtubs.
We have been shamed to not discussing these problems, and that's why people don't know about it.
Catherine Coleman Flowers is founder of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice. For years, she's worked to address sanitation problems in Lowndes County, Alabama, where she grew up. There, many residents live beyond the reach of the municipal wastewater system, so they rely on septic systems to filter wastewater on-site. But their septic systems often fail. Flowers says they do not work effectively in this region because hard clay soil does not absorb water well. And climate change is causing more extreme storms.
If we get a lot of rain, the septic systems are going to fail.
Flowers says that the problem goes beyond Lowndes County. People in many regions face similar challenges. So she says it's important to develop new technologies that can handle the changing climate.
With sea level rise and groundwater levels increasing, we got to do something different.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 10th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Samantha Hong-Long, Eric Tegadoff, Eric Galatix, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, following politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host Dimae Roberts highlights art, literature, and media. All of these wonderful KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are currently in our spring membership drive, so if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
This week on Making Contact.
You'll be sitting watching something on a film and something like that will come up, some sort of psychological abuse or physical abuse. And within a second, it takes you right back. And it was 27 years ago. It's never left me. And at my age, I don't think it ever will.
Domestic abuse affects everyone it touches. Intimate partners, children, and elders. Victims of domestic violence, regardless of where they are in the world, can share similar experiences of abuse and their escape from it. Fortunately, even in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, support services in the U.S. and around the world are continuing to operate 24/7. But the pandemic has created new problems and made some worse. This was particularly true during the early weeks of the shelter-in-place orders. In this show, we'll hear from an advocate who provides services to victims of domestic violence about the challenges that COVID-19 poses for victims and their advocates. But first, we head to the United Kingdom, where lawmakers are considering a landmark bill that could change the way countries in the UK handle domestic abuse cases and potentially establish misogyny as a hate crime. From London, here's Rosie McLeod with the story.
On the 23rd of March, UK residents were ordered to stay at home to stop the spread of COVID-19. 2 weeks later, calls to the domestic abuse helpline shot up by 120% within a single 24-hour window. By supporting survivors through the proposed domestic abuse bill, lawmakers hope to end the long-term effects that accompany violence in the home.
I've skimmed the report, I'll be honest, and yeah. There's nothing in there that I can say I may be wrong about funding.
Karen Bellamy is the CEO of LVE Charitable Foundation and holds a local elected office. Bellamy is compiling an exhaustive report into issues of domestic violence, violence against women and girls, and the response of charities, shelters, doctors, and the police. The work is rooted in her personal experience.
In a past relationship, I suffered 10 years what I would call extreme domestic violence and psychological abuse. So from being beaten to being locked in the flat 12 floors high and being told, I hope there's not a fire today.
That level of control extended beyond the walls of Karen Bellamy's home.
I stopped working. My partner wrote the letter that said that I was leaving, because when I used to leave from work, he would wait for me. And if a man at work, a boy at work, said anything to me when I got home, oftentimes the clothes that I was wearing that day would be torn off me and just ripped to bits.
Karen Bellamy escaped this relationship, but it took years. Now, as a survivor, she uses her platform to help other victims of abuse. Through her experience, Bellamy understands the deep-running repercussions that survivors live with.
It's still very hard, because you'll be sitting watching something on a film or something, and something like that will come up, some sort of psychological abuse or physical abuse, and within a second, a nanosecond, it takes you right back. I mean, I'm 60 now, and it was 27 years ago, so it will never It's never left me. And at my age, I don't think it ever will.
Domestic violence extends beyond the physical, from the drip-drip of psychological abuse to control over finances. Karen Bellamy experienced a form of this when her abuser forced her to quit her job. Under the UK's Domestic Abuse Bill, this would constitute economic abuse, that is, interfering with someone's ability to acquire, keep, and use money. But that is just one part of it. An overarching goal in passing this bill is to completely revamp the way legal systems and the public define domestic abuse. Councillor Grace Williams is a local cabinet member for children, young people and families.
Abuse doesn't just look like physical abuse. You know, it can be coercive control, it can be emotional, it can be financial. So for us, having that kind of comprehensive definition of abuse will help us to tackle the issues that we're facing, you know, how it affects different family members, including children, how it affects people's ability to, you know, move out of the situation and be in financial control. So I think it's much clearer about, you know, the impact on the victim and ensuring that the victim is recognised as a person who needs support rather than having a kind of adversarial legal system.
According to documents on the Home Office website, the definition of domestic abuse in the bill comes in two parts. The first part deals with the relationship between the abuser and the abused. The second part defines what constitutes abusive behaviour. The new definition would be helpful because it reframes the issue away from common misconceptions of domestic abuse.
The onus is on the victim to change their behaviour by leaving. And if you look at the sort of dialogue about it, it's all about, well, why does the woman stay? Why has she gone back? Why didn't she report it? But we know that things are more complex than that, and we know that we have to put some responsibility on the perpetrator to actually change their behaviour. So the focus on the perpetrator is for them to see their behaviour as a problem, and that's a really key part of it.
The bill also proposes a measure very similar to sex offender registries in the US and the UK. Like Meghan and Sarah's laws, it's also named after the case that implicated it.
Claire's law is part of the bill, which will be a list of, like the sexual abuse list, like the paedophile list, so that you can go on and see if somebody has been prosecuted or has any history of domestic abuse. So when you meet somebody, you don't know. You know, you don't know the ins and outs of where they've been, what they've done. It's a new situation. You're getting to know people. Whereas if you can check that, you can protect yourself. And to me, that's what Claire's Law is about, is being able to protect yourself and potential victims being able to take control.
While some have criticised the law's female name because it implies that only women suffer domestic abuse, Claire's Law has been largely welcomed as a protective measure against it. Women's Aid is one of four charities working to end domestic violence throughout the UK. In 2019, they reported that 64% of referrals to shelters were declined. The Domestic Abuse Bill would seek to remedy that by guaranteeing safe accommodation for those fleeing domestic abuse in England. Refuge is the UK's largest provider of shelter services. From Refuge, here's Cordelia Tucker O'Sullivan.
The number of bed spaces available in England is currently 30% below the minimum number recommended by the Council of Europe. And this shortfall makes it really difficult for some women to access refuge accommodation and often takes a woman several attempts before she is successful. There is a new legal duty in the Domestic Abuse Bill currently going through Parliament on local areas to assess need for accommodation-based services for survivors of domestic abuse and make sure that they commission services based on that need.
Because of that legal duty, Tucker O'Sullivan is hopeful that the bill could relieve increased stress on the shelter's system, particularly during the pandemic.
Refuge really welcomes the Domestic Abuse Bill. It's been several years in the making, so we're really pleased that it's making progress and will return to Parliament in the autumn.
We are particularly pleased that the new legal duty on local areas is included in there so that refuge accommodation can finally be put on a more sustainable footing. As the government has said on many occasions, this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to transform the response to domestic abuse.
While groups are welcoming the bill, its authors left out protections for one of the most vulnerable populations in the UK, migrant women and children. Some people, because of their immigration status, are afraid to report their abuser, and some are even denied shelter when fleeing for their lives. This leaves some immigrant women and kids with fewer options. Groups such as Step Up Migrant Women UK are calling for safe reporting mechanisms for immigrant women to be included in the bill.
I mean, I suppose this is just what our legal system's like, isn't it? It kind of, it's the sort of legal system that's got all these kind of, well, it's just very old-fashioned, isn't it?
Many internet users, often women, cite the UK law as failing to protect people against crimes aided by digital technologies.
For example, those around revenge porn. Revenge porn is now illegal in this country as of, I think it was April, the law came in. And
Refuge has noted shortcomings of this nature in the domestic abuse bill.
One area that is currently missing and that Refuge has launched a campaign on are threatening to share intimate images. Refuge has a specialist tech abuse team that was set up a couple of years ago, and they told us that one of the biggest problems the women we support were facing is threats from abusers to share intimate images of them without their consent. Threatening to share an intimate image is not currently a crime, even though the actual sharing of the image is. Refuge conducted a survey that found 1 in 14 adults in England and Wales have been threatened with sharing an intimate image. This is equivalent to 4.4 million people. This issue is even more prevalent amongst young people, with 1 in 7 young women having experienced threats to share intimate images. The vast majority of threats to share intimate images take place in a domestic abuse context, so it is unquestionably a domestic abuse issue.
Refuge's research found that 83% of women felt such threats negatively impacted their mental and emotional well-being, with 1 in 10 feeling suicidal as a result. A further 1 in 10 felt forced to compromise their safety by granting the abuser access to children or even resuming the abusive relationship.
Refuge then launched the campaign, The Naked Threat, to change the law and make this form of domestic abuse illegal. The government now has the perfect opportunity with the domestic abuse bill to make changes to the law and make threats to share intimate images a crime.
Both Refuge's campaign and Claire's Law indicate new preventative methods for tackling domestic abuse. And another proposed deterrent is the motion to make misogyny a hate crime. This would allow judges to impose longer sentences for crimes against women.
I'll put it all here in one sentence, right? I think men should be grateful that women want equality, not revenge.
Comedian and activist Kate Smurthwaite famously suffers a large amount of misogynistic online abuse. Her trolls have even written to the venues hiring her, falsely claiming she is difficult to work with and does not pay her taxes.
I have been to the police and reported crimes, both online and offline, and said to the police, well, this is definitely motivated by sexism, this is motivated by misogyny. And firstly, the police have referred me to agencies who specifically support victims of hate crime, and I've then gone to those agencies and they've gone, oh no, sorry, misogyny doesn't count. And I also have had the experience of experiencing hate crime that was definitely about me being a woman, but that was also contained racist elements. And which might seem weird given that I'm white, and not that people were hating me for being white, but quite the opposite, that people were using racist language towards me because I was dating somebody who wasn't white, or I was with somebody who wasn't white, or I was talking about race-related issues, and their conclusion was, well, you're of no use to the white race. And I do notice that when there's racism or anti-Semitism in the abuse, it does get taken more seriously by the police, which leads me to believe that if we classified being a woman as one of the characteristics that was protected, it would push the police to take this stuff more seriously.
Like Claire's Law and Refuge's campaign, making misogyny a hate crime would strike at the root of domestic abuse. the preventative approaches would not only target the cycle of abuse, but also help to end the victim blaming that many report. All of the campaigners I've spoken to agree that the proposals will improve lives, provided one condition. Kate Smurthwaite.
There isn't enough funding. The fact is that the vast majority of people seeking help just can't have it because there isn't somewhere safe to put them, or they end up on a waiting list and then they have to go back and keep waiting around. Of course, it's great that the new legislation is saying that local authorities must provide accommodation, but I also think that we have to be aware that simply telling local authorities you must provide X, Y, and Z without providing any extra funding for it, all it means is that now local authorities will have less money to spend on libraries and playgrounds and all of these other vital resources. And actually, it's going to create its own problems. What the government actually needs to do is not just say it's your obligation to provide, but actually say, and here is the resource that's going to allow you to do that. At one point in the UK, and it may well still be true, the top three charities that address violence against women and girls in the UK receive less funding in total than a single donkey sanctuary in Devon.
This issue runs deeper than simply acquiring the money from the public purse. Councillor Grace Williams.
The problem is that the underfunding is just so severe. It's in so many areas that it's hard to know where to start. The interesting thing is that government has started to recognise after the pandemic, or in the pandemic, it's not really after it, is it, that there is a need for public funding. But the problem is that the underfunding has gone on for so long, for 10 years, that we just will not be able to fix it quickly. We had dozens of staff who work all around the council who were deployed to really focus on supporting our domestic abuse drop-in. Schools have remained open and schools have done an amazing amount of outreach to the families that they know that would be vulnerable by phone, and we don't have extra money to do that. We've just sort of done it. And now local authorities will have, you know, a massive deficit to pay just for the last few months. So, for example, we calculate the deficit. The money that we have used that will not be funded by central government for the services we've used to support vulnerable people is something like £23 million already in those few months.
Having allocated the emergency funding during lockdown, the UK has proved it can afford to help troubled people when necessary and adapt policy accordingly. If the bill passes, perhaps the new measures will give victims of abuse the support they need to get help. Karen Bellamy.
I think at the moment the stigma around domestic violence is less than it was all those years ago, but I think there is still in society a stigma about speaking out about any emotional trauma, which is very damaging. And I think hopefully this bill will help women to look at that and say, right, there is a law and I can go and get help. Back when I was being abused, which as I said ended 27 years ago, there was very little. There was very little advice from anyone. I spent at 1.3 weeks in hospital because of it. But there was no referral. There was no, well, you can go and get help here or there. They gave me Valium or sleeping pills, and that was the solution all those years ago.
The Domestic Abuse Bill has already been passed by the House of Commons, the UK's main house, where it was heralded as groundbreaking. It is now awaiting its final approval by the country's upper house, the House of Lords, who will debate the bill and its wording when Parliament resumes in the autumn. Only then can the proposals become law. For Making Contact, I'm Rosie McLeod, reporting from London.
You're listening to Domestic Violence in Lockdown, COVID-19 and the UK's Domestic Abuse Bill on Making Contact. For information and resources about domestic violence and support services, go to our website at radioproject.org and click on this week's show. When we come back, we'll hear how survivors of domestic abuse and their advocates have been navigating the pandemic.
In March of 2020, countries around the world issued stay-at-home orders to curb the spread of COVID-19. As one Philadelphia Women's Center advocate put it, it was a pandemic within the pandemic of domestic violence. I recently spoke with Elizabeth Jimenez-Yanez, the Policy Communications Coordinator on Violence Against Women and Girls at the Latin American Women's Rights Service in London. We talked about how migrant women in the UK are campaigning to be included in the domestic abuse bill, and about the similarities in intimate partner violence in the US and the UK during the pandemic.
We heard about this surge on domestic abuse cases and incidents in China, for instance, and then afterwards in other countries in Europe, France, Italy. So these trends are repeating, and these increasing levels of violence against women and girls was something that was expected as lockdowns were imposed. But I think something that it's important to mention is that it's important to speak about the nuances of these increasing numbers, because we are a service that is very embedded in the community. And that means that a lot of women got to know about our services through the community, so word of mouth. So women used to go to our offices, just pop up and ask to talk to an advisor, or just call our office and ask for an appointment. And what happened to us from our experience is that at the beginning, we didn't see this like high amount of calls, but that didn't mean that we were not experiencing like a surge in domestic abuse cases. What we knew is that for women, it was more difficult to reach for help, but also because we work with women who face multiple and overlapping barriers, this was even more difficult. For instance, we work with women who don't speak English, and the language barrier plays like a huge role on how to support, on how to flee abuse. So what was happening, according to our caseworkers, was that a case of a survivor or a victim that in the past took like a couple of hours to sort out, now was taking a couple of days or even a week.
You said that the cases are becoming more complex. And can you just elaborate a little bit more about how that is happening?
So the lockdown was like a fertile ground for this isolation to become even worse. So the complexity of the cases relied on having to live trapped with the perpetrator meant that for many women, they were not able to contain the abuse anymore, because in the past they were able to either go to work, to go to the school, or the perpetrator to go to work, for instance, so they had some time off. So something that we started to monitor, and we are aiming to have more numbers, is increase of sexual violence within the domestic abuse. So marital rape was something that caseworkers were reporting more and more amongst the cases that they were receiving.
During the pandemic?
Yeah, during the lockdown. Yeah, at the time that they were trapped with their perpetrators, that was a trend we identified. Another thing that was like, just to give you an example, this is just one case. We had a woman who has a child with the perpetrator, and the perpetrator, he has the custody of the child. So when the lockdown started, he immediately said to her, like, you cannot visit her, you cannot take her home with you because of the pandemic. So the abuse, like, again, the child was used like as a tool to coerce her and to exert violence towards her. I think she didn't manage to see her daughter for at least 3 months. So in general, we saw that the experiences of violence of the service users increased, and the forms of violence diversified.
And you said that there are generally multiple and overlapping barriers for migrant women. Can you talk a bit more about what those are, and maybe give me an example of how they manifest?
It's not new with the pandemic. This was exacerbated by the pandemic. Something that it's a huge barrier for migrant women with insecure immigration status. That means women who don't have a settled status in the UK, which includes women on spousal visas, women on temporary visas, asylum-seeking women, undocumented women, of course, are not able to access public funds. And that's a huge barrier, because even before the pandemic, it was shown that 4 out of 5 women, this is information from a national organization called Women Safe, were turned away from shelters because they don't have access to public funds. Why is that? Because in this country, shelters are paid through benefits, the housing benefit. And when you are a woman who doesn't have access to public funds, you cannot access this benefit. And then it's very difficult that shelters get you in. But it's not only that, it's also the fact that you cannot access to benefits. And as you know, many women who face violence against women and girls as part of the abuse, they experience financial and economic abuse. And this creates a dependency with the perpetrator. Even if they work, many women, their money is taken away from them. Migrant women and migrants in general with insecure immigration status face the possibility of being detained and deported when asking for support. So in the case of migrant women, this is and survivors of domestic abuse, this is very worrying because migrant women face a real risk of detention or deportation when, for instance, reporting the abuse to the police. Because in this country, they have prioritized immigration enforcement and immigration control over the safety of victims.
So the police don't have an obligation to report to the Home Office, but there are some who still do that voluntarily.
Yeah, I think this is a good opportunity for me to tell you what we are doing with the domestic abuse bill. There's no clear guidance for the police on how to proceed and support a woman with insecure immigration status. And in fact, in 2018, there was a freedom of information request that it was done by some journalists to the police, and they found out that 60% of police forces in the United Kingdom were sharing information with the Home Office for Immigration Enforcement. So that's very worrying. And what we are doing with the Domestic Abuse Bill is we are living on an amendment that would incorporate to the bill the establishment of safe reporting mechanisms and an end to data sharing between police and other statutory services and the Home Office for Immigration Enforcement. So what we are arguing is that due to this lack of guidance, police and some police officers are still sharing the information with the Home Office. And as I told you already, the consequences are terrible for survivors and for victims. And this shouldn't happen. And migrant women's safety should be prioritized always and put above any kind of immigration enforcement.
How has that campaigning work been going for you as far as being able to make some of those changes that you all are working towards in the domestic abuse bill?
So it's been very challenging because it's not a secret that the government of the UK, it's hostile towards migration. The narrative is completely hostile. So only one of them was voted, and it was an amendment that aimed to lift the no recourse to public funds policy that I told you before during the duration of a pilot project that the government is presenting as an alternative for migrant women. It was completely voted against by conservatives, like all of them, all the members of the House of Commons. And what we are doing now is our strategy is moving towards the House of Lords to incorporate these changes to the bill. Otherwise, this bill that has been presented as this landmark piece of legislation is not going to be that. It's going to be failing many vulnerable women who are prevented from accessing safety, support, and justice. So, I mean, this is a very personal reflection, but we at Lords, we are all migrant women, and many of us are migrant women with insecure immigration status working on this. And we are sitting on the table with decision makers. We are centering the voices of survivors who, as part of the abuse, have been always, their voice has been silenced. Part of our aims of the campaign since the beginning has been to put at the center the stories and the voices of these women. So policy changes are based on real stories, on women's stories who know how the system is failing them.
That was Elizabeth Jimenez-Yanez of the Latin American Women's Rights Service in London. You've been listening to Domestic Violence in Lockdown, COVID-19 and the UK's Domestic Abuse Bill on Making Contact. For information about this show and resources about domestic violence and support services, go to our website at radioproject.org. The Making Contact team is Sonia Green, Lisa Rudman, Anita Johnson, Salima Hamarani, Sabine Blazin, Emily Rose Thorne, and I'm this week's host, Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact. We'll be right back.